Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, it's producer Amanda checking in to make sure everyone is staying sane and safe during this very anxious time. A quick announcement, we are going to continue to record episodes of The Alarmist remotely and with no guest in order to comply with quarantine guidelines. We're pushing off a few previously scheduled episodes, like the Astor Place riots, in order to bring you more topical content and some lighter subjects to ease all of our anxiety during this difficult time. Coming up next week is Who is to Blame for Toilet Paper Hoarding? Don't miss that. We're also going to continue with Aftermath episodes. Coming up is a mailbag episode, so write in with any questions for The Alarmist Rebecca, fact checker Chris, or producer Amanda, me. Questions about the podcast or personal questions. We would also love to hear your opinions on the state of the world, how you're handling quarantine, or opinions on past episodes. Email us at thealarmistpodcast@gmail.com. Tweet us at alarmistthe. Instagram us at thealarmistpodcast. Or better yet, leave us a voicemail at 844-370-8643. Now here's today's Aftermath.
An Erio's original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath.
Hey everyone, welcome to The Aftermath. Today, we are talking to guest expert Phil Scratton, author of Hillsborough, The Truth, and Professor Emeritus in the School of Law at Queen's University in Belfast. You heard a bit of it on Tuesday's episode, but here we're going to play you the extended cut because every second of it is so interesting.
So thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us about this. Right off the bat, if you could just tell us some of the main factors that led to this tragedy. I understand this is a loaded question, but as best to your ability.
I think the important issue about Hillsborough is that there were two versions from the outset. First of all, there was the official version, which came from the police primarily, and that was then developed further by the investigating agencies. And in this case, because it was such a major tragedy involving the deaths of so many people and injuries to many others, and witnessed, I might say, by 50,000 people who were actually in the stadium and beamed live by television, it was obviously, clearly, of national interest. And right at the outset, the commander in charge, the police commander in charge, stated that Liverpool fans had stormed the ground, broken an exit gate, gone down the tunnel into already overcrowded pens. And you have to understand pens as being penned to the side and the front and not seated, standing only. And people there were crushed. There were approximately, now we've worked out, there were nearly 2.5 times as many people on those steps there should have been. And the official version that came primarily from the police in the immediacy of the tragedy, before people had been pulled out of the pens, the match commander had stated that they had rushed the ground. Now, everybody who was involved in that directly and survived stated that was untrue. And over the next week after the disaster, and it was the 15th of April 1989, and in the days that followed, a version of events came from the police which reinforced that early notion. It was clear they hadn't broken down the gate. That was disproved even on the night of the disaster. The gate had been opened to relieve a crush outside the ground, but the fans had entered the ground, and a ground that they weren't familiar with, a stadium they weren't familiar with, and they went down a tunnel that was directly opposite them, not knowing where it led. It was a 1-in-6 gradient tunnel. It was illegal, actually. And they went into the back of already crowded pens. They were unstewarded. And the compression became so great, they couldn't get back up the tunnel because more people were coming down. And the lack of stewarding, the lack of policing, meant that the people in the pens, and those pens were crushed. A barrier collapsed, and people went down one on top of each other. And because there were high fences around the stadium, the police on the outside and the first aiders on the outside couldn't get into the pens to get people out. So the version that came out in the early days, the Liverpool fans were totally responsible, dominated the media. It dominated the investigations by the police. It dominated the investigations by the judicial inquiry. And it also dominated the inquests, the initial inquests that were held 1.5 years after the disaster occurred. And in actual fact, the inquests gave a verdict of accidental death. Now, that was contrary to all that was known from the fans' experiences, all that we could see on television and the coverage, etc. And almost immediately after the disaster, I formed the Hillsborough Project, which was funded by Liverpool City Council, which is where most people came from who were in the stadium, Liverpool, or certainly the Liverpool fans came from. And I formed that project. And we produced two reports, one in 1990, so very soon after the disaster, and another more substantive report in 1995, which demonstrated that not only were the fans not to blame, not only were the fans not responsible, but there were very serious failures in the condition of the stadium, the policing, the stewarding, the safety, that this was a tragedy waiting to happen. And so we challenged the verdict. And that challenge to the verdict brought about a very well-known film by one of Liverpool's great filmmakers, Jimmy McGovern, called Hillsborough. That came out in 1996. But it was quite clear we were getting nowhere with our critique. So in 1999, 10 years after the disaster, I decided to write the book, Hillsborough, The Truth. And in that book, I exposed not only the real causes and the real circumstances of the disaster, but I also demonstrated how seriously the investigations and inquiries had failed. And that was the beginning, I think, of a counter move to actually try and access the truth. Now, the interesting thing about that was that when the book came out, it was greeted with major coverage in all the media. It was serialized in some of the newspapers. And I really thought at that moment that the inquest verdicts would be quashed and that it would all be reinvestigated. And what was really staggering was that nothing happened. I call the decade of the 2000s, from 2000 till 2010, the fallow decade, when nothing happened. And it was only after the persistence of the Hillsborough Family Support Group and also my own work on the research that in 2009 the government agreed to reopen the investigation 20 years on, and the Hillsborough Independent Panel was formed.
My question really is, when it comes to the police and their part in the tragedy, would you place the blame more on Duckinfield himself or the South Yorkshire Police as a whole?
I think it's important to really understand the complexity of Duckinfield's appointment as the match commander on the day. He had only been in charge of policing two previous matches, games, at that stadium. And he was inexperienced. In the film Hillsborough, we demonstrate the reason, very clear reason, why he was given so little lead-in time. There had been a scandal within the South Yorkshire Police Force, and his predecessor, who had experience of being match commander at Hillsborough, was removed from the job. Duckinfield was parachuted in, but he had an experienced team around him. And when he was caught in the headlights in the police control box, and he could see that there was a crowd outside that was becoming quite dangerous, when he made that decision to open the gate, you would have expected his senior officers, who had a long experience of policing that stadium, would have intervened, and they didn't. So the issue is that whilst he, of course, was responsible for the decision to open the gates, while, of course, he was responsible for the lie that he immediately told that went all around the world, there were others, not only the match commander, the ground commander, the commander outside the ground, all of those senior officers who had experience of policing Hillsborough and who contributed through their own negligence and neglect to the situation, the escalation of the situation. So, yes, Duckinfield had to be held responsible for his own failings, but there were others who failed very much so as well on the day.
Yes, and can you talk to us a little bit about the climate in the 80s between the Liverpool community and the South Yorkshire Police?
Well, there hadn't really been much of a climate between Liverpool people and the South Yorkshire Police in the 1980s. What there was in South Yorkshire was a climate between working class people who lived in South Yorkshire, and many of whom either worked down the mines, the pits, or had, it was a big pit area, big mining area, or had family members who worked down the pits. And there had been, during the early 80s, from 1984 to 1985, there had been a miners' strike. And the police were very heavily criticized for the way in which they went in hard against the miners who were on strike. So the South Yorkshire Police came to Hillsborough at the end of the 1980s with a tarnished reputation for heavy-handed policing. And it's interesting when I look back, because I wrote the book, The State of the Police, in 1985, and examined a lot of the South Yorkshire policing of that coal dispute, the miners' strike. And it's interesting to note that many of the senior officers who were responsible for that heavy-handedness were also senior officers who policed Hillsborough 4 years later.
That I think you're right. I think that's a very important point to kind of touch upon. Now, we talk a lot about the segregation of the fans as a major factor in this tragedy. Why were the Liverpool fans assigned the Leppings Lane entrance with so few turnstiles?
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I think that it doesn't really make any difference which set of fans had been in the stadium. It was a capacity crowd. And if that part of the stadium was unsafe for Liverpool fans, it would have been equally unsafe for Nottingham Forest fans who they were playing on the day. In actual fact, as our work showed, and as my book and as the Hillsborough Independent Panel report, which I'll come to in a minute, showed there had been a very near tragedy in 1981 when Wolverhampton Wanderers played Tottenham Hotspur, and that was in the Leppings Lane end. But at that time, the terrace wasn't broken up by pens, so when it became overcrowded, people could disperse sideways and weren't trapped within the barriers. So it was a danger for whoever was in that end of the stadium. It was decrepit. It was out of date. The barriers were old, and you know all of the lack of safety was a lack of safety for whoever had been in there. The issue about why Liverpool fans were assigned that end is quite simply because they were approaching the stadium from Liverpool across the Pennines, and they were approaching the stadium literally from that end of the stadium, whereas those coming up from the Midlands were approaching the stadium from the other end. So it would have meant they would have had to cross over to have gone to opposite ends. That was the official explanation, and it's one that is fairly logical. But I want to emphasize that it doesn't matter who was in that stadium at that end, in those circumstances, the deaths would have followed because it was a capacity crowd. And I think that sometimes that becomes a bit of a red herring to the issues, the real underlying issues of causation in terms of the disaster.
Yes, it seemed like there was an extreme lack of coordination on the part of the stadium owners. And in your opinion, and lack of safety, were there steps that the stadium owners and the management could have taken to ease the bottlenecking on the Leppings Lane section?
Well, I think that we have to look at the way in which that game was managed, this match was managed. The Football Association hired the stadium from Sheffield Wednesday Football Club. So the owners play no real part other than hiring their stadium out to the Football Association. The Football Association failed dramatically to act on the dangers that had been clear the previous year when Liverpool played exactly the same team, Nottingham Forest, and had been crushing. They failed to act on the knowledge that they had from the previous semi-final when there had been crushing. That's the one I mentioned between Tottenham Hotspur and Wolverhampton Wanderers. And so, you know, the issue around the responsibility lay with the Football Association, but it also lay with the South Yorkshire Police, because they were responsible for the policing outside the stadium, and then the club's officials were responsible for the stewarding inside the stadium, but also the police were responsible for stewarding inside the stadium. So it was the complex mix of those institutions that had to bear the brunt, in first of all, in my opinion, had to bear the brunt, but now, subsequently, with the second inquest, have been held responsible for all of those failings.
You would point the finger less at the actual stadium owners and more at the association.
Well, I think that the stadium owners had a duty to keep their stadium in good repair. And they argued that the local authority, that's the Sheffield City Council, had passed their stadium as fit for purpose. Now, we've explored that too, and we found that the actual examination of the stadium, the assessment of the stadium as being fit for purpose, was inadequate, and we've exposed that as well, and we've held the local authority responsible for that in our independent panel's report, which led to the more recent sequence of events. So, you know, it was a mixture of all of those issues, and we've been very careful in our work to actually apportion responsibility clearly to each of those institutions. But the overarching responsibility was actually the responsibility of the police for a safe passage of the fans in the approach to the stadium. And we have to remember they're being led by the police through what are Victorian back-to-back housing streets. So it's not exactly like we would think of a modern stadium where there's a big area outside of openness where people can be dispersed. They were very tightly confined. So they were led there by the police. They were led into the stadium by the police. They were supposedly regulated outside through these old Victorian-type turnstiles, which is where the first bottleneck occurred. But that whole entire process, I mean, when you think of that area outside of the back of the Leppings Lane Terrace, there was a wall on one side and a river on the other, and there were only limited turnstiles through which all of the Liverpool fans had to pass. When we worked it out, twice as many fans had to pass through those turnstiles than in any other area of the ground in the same allotted time. So it was, as I've argued so many times, a tragedy waiting to happen.
And that is such an important detail. Thank you for walking us through just what it looks like for those of us who have never been there. It sounds like to me, if you had to pick, what I know there is an abundance of failures that led to this tragedy, but if you had to pick what is the most to blame, you would ultimately choose perhaps the police. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, it's not that I would choose it. They've now been held culpable.
Yes.
I mean, you know, one of the things that's been so important, and that where I would want to pick up on the story, and I'll be brief as I possibly can, what I want to pick up on is that once we had the independent panel, we had access to 2 million documents from all the authorities. We had my research team based in my university over 2 years, examined documents from over 80 different sources, including 50 institutions. This was a mammoth task. And when we went through those documents, we were able to trace precisely where responsibility laid at every stage of the process, in terms of the long history, in terms of the immediate context, in terms of the circumstances on the day, and I have to say, in terms of the aftermath, because what came afterwards was a major cover-up, and we've exposed all of that. I mean, I can say this without any fear of libel, because we not only demonstrated it, but when we got that to the second inquest, which came after we'd published our report, the decision was taken to annul the verdict from the first inquests and to hold new inquests, which lasted, believe it or not, for 2 full years. And I was on secondment to the legal teams throughout those 2 years, and we re-examined all that we had been through on the independent panel. And what came out of that were 25 findings against the authorities, 15 of which were against the police. And the verdict, the short-form verdict that was delivered, was that the fans hadn't died accidentally, but they had been unlawfully killed. And the nature of our system is, when you have a verdict that such as unlawful killing, you cannot attribute it directly to any given individual. But what they could do, and what the jury did do, was to name 15 substantive failings in the policing on the day which contributed to that unlawful killing. And then the other authorities were also blamed, the architects and the emergency response and so on and so forth. But the most important element of that verdict, and I'll never forget this because I was obviously sitting in court and we had over 40 barristers working for the families in the most, it's the longest inquest in legal history in the UK. And we were sitting there, and when the jury foreperson was asked, did the fans in any way contribute to this disaster? She stood there and everybody waited, and she just said no. Wow. So what we saw at that dramatic moment in the court was a complete reversal of the first inquests. Now in a court of law, the police were being held responsible. Now in a court of law, the other bodies that had contributed were being held responsible. And now in a court of law, the fans were completely exonerated of any responsibility for the disaster on the day. And yet for the previous, at that time, 25 years, the general public, fueled by a hostile media, had actually held Liverpool fans responsible for the deaths of their own people.
Wow.
I knew that was wrong all the way through. Our report stated that. Hillsborough the Truth in all of its editions stated that. But now in the court of law, it changed. And every newspaper the following day apologized. Every newspaper that had previously held fans responsible front-paged the issue, stating that the fans were exonerated and the authorities were held responsible.
Well, Phil, thank you so, so much for helping us understand this terrible tragedy and how it all unfolded. And thank you so much for your work in helping uncover the truth of what happened that day.
I want to just give you, and you might want to put this in or not.
Yes.
I want to give you a quote.
Please.
This is from Eddie Spirit, who became a close friend of mine over the years. His son died in his arms, and he lost consciousness and woke up at 5 o'clock on the day, 2 hours after the disaster, in a terrible state in hospital. And many years ago, I interviewed Eddie, and he became a close friend. This is his quote. The crush came. It was like a vice getting tighter and tighter and tighter. I turned Adam round to me. He was obviously in distress. There was a police officer on the track through the fence about 5 or 6 feet away, and I begged him to open the gate. I was screaming, my lovely son is dying, begging him to help. He just stood and looked at me. I punched the fence right at the beginning when I was begging the officer to open the gate. I could have got Adam out. I know that. Because I was there. Eddie became a great friend. and he died in 2011 from the early onset of Alzheimer's. This articulate working class man, a great fighter, died as a direct consequence of long-term injuries sustained at Hillsborough, and he lost his son.
It's unthinkable and just devastating. We will make sure that these stories continue to be told, and it's just important that we continue to talk about them.
Yeah, and it's important that I continue to research them, and that's exactly what I'm doing at the moment in Northern Ireland with other cases.
Well, thank you so much, Phil.
Rebecca, thank you for your interest, and good luck with the broadcast and the podcast. Anytime, just get in touch.
Again, we want to thank Phil for taking the time to speak to us. This was an absolutely devastating tragedy. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to chime in with all of your thoughts at thealarmistpodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us on social media on Twitter @alarmistthe or Instagram @thealarmistpodcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. See you next time.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.